Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the 2026 legislative session. This is the first meeting of the House Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. I want to welcome everyone. And we do have some housekeeping things that we're going to go through before we get started with the agenda for today. A quorum is present. And as chair, I just want to make a couple of remarks, and then we'll turn it over to Co-Chair Liebling, see if she has any remarks to make. But I just want to thank Chair Liebling for the work that we were able to do last year and really worked hard together and tried to keep everything at an even keel and just do what was right for the people of Minnesota and funding the judiciary and so forth. And so I hope that we will continue that relationship this year and just the quorum of this, or the decorum of this committee, and just being respectful to everybody. And with that, I will turn it over to Chair Liebling for a few comments.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Scott. And I don't have really much to add, just glad to be back and glad to see everyone and looking forward to the work ahead. So thank you.
Sounds good. All right. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think because this is Mr. Sandy's first meeting, we do have a new person, even not a new member. So we should give him an opportunity.
Good catch. Please introduce yourself.
Thanks, everyone. I'm Josh Sandy. I'm the new CA. I don't have a new placard yet to reflect that, but I'm Anna's immediate successor. I was here during the trifecta on the Health Committee, so I'm just happy to be back doing work that matters at such a pivotal time. So looking forward to getting work done.
Thank you, Mr. Sandy. It's good to have you aboard. So I'm going to start reading the safety notices, and we're not sure if this is going to have to be read every committee or not, but we're going to start out for sure today. To ensure everyone can view, hear, and understand today's proceedings, we ask for your cooperation in maintaining decorum and civility throughout this hearing. For the safety, security, and comfort of all attendees, please note the following guidelines. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, or disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause or other audible demonstrations are not allowed. Standing or sitting in walkways and aisles is prohibited. If you require any accommodation, please speak to the sergeant staff wearing gold ties. State troopers and house security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. Those providing testimony will be given specific time limits, which must be strictly observed. If you receive an entrance ticket, please retain it as it may be provided for re-entry if you leave the hearing room. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in the removal from the hearing room. Our goal is to conduct this hearing efficiently while ensuring everyone the opportunity to observe and participate appropriately. With that, we will... Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for reading that. I know that security staff really appreciate that, and since we have different people coming all the time to different committee hearings, if we can continue to read that every hearing, I would appreciate it, and I believe our security staff would too. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and I agree with you. We will move on to the minutes of April 10th, 2025. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Curran.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Curran. Has moved the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted. Members, you have a copy of the committee rules in your packets still. They have not changed from last year. Just reminders that amendments must be received by the committee administrator by 4 p.m. The day prior to the scheduled hearing. Individuals wishing to testify before the committee should notify the committee administrator by noon the day before the scheduled hearing. Any questions? And Representative Finke, if you're going to bring chocolate, you have to share with everybody. All right. I don't know yet. Well, I'm going to make it in the rules. All right. We have two presentations today. As you know, last session we were able to reinstate the volunteer guardian ad litem board or guardian ad litems. And so we're going to hear from the guardian ad litem second. But first, we're going to hear from the Minnesota Competency Attainment Board. So I would welcome them, Ms. Larson, to come to the testifiers table. And there are, it looks like PowerPoint presentations in our packets. Please introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. Is this on? Yes. Okay. Thank you, Chair Scott, Chair Liebling, members of the committee for inviting us here. I'm Kim Larson. I'm the program administrator for the Competency Attainment Board. I'm going to try to juggle a presentation and my written notes, so please feel free to let me know if I get out of sync a little bit as I go through this. So today I'm going to share just a brief summary with you of where we were last year about this time, the first time that we were able to testify and provide information in front of this committee. And then I'm going to spend most of my time talking about what we've accomplished since last year's session. So just quickly, as you know, the Competency Attainment Board is an independent board within the judicial branch. Slide 3 of the presentation is just to give you a picture of the board's mission and vision statements that they established in 2024. We use those to guide all of the work that we do to continue to build this program. There we go. So the statute sets an overarching set of duties and responsibilities for the board. The two primary items from which everything else flows are to certify competency attainment programs and to use forensic navigators throughout the state of Minnesota to both promote prevention and the diversion of people with mental illnesses and cognitive impairments from entering the legal system. And then once they are in the legal system, supporting them through the competency process and assisting courts and partners in coordinating services for those individuals. So last year around this time, we shared with this committee that we were structured our initial efforts in what we were calling a soft launch. The board opted for this approach because they quickly realized the complexities of creating a brand new state agency, developing and getting approval for new job classifications in the state, and then going through the hiring process. It wasn't going to be as immediate as I think we had initially hoped. The goals of the soft launch were pretty simple and clear. One, to hire at least 10 forensic navigators, preferably one in each judicial district, and then to also provide services as much as possible throughout the state of Minnesota. This slide, which is slide 5, shows the information that we shared last year around those activities. I'm happy to share that today we've transitioned out of the soft launch phase, and we are now solidly in a growth phase. What we're looking to accomplish is growing the number of forensic navigators that we have on board, their areas within which they reside around the state of Minnesota. We are also looking at growing the number of certified competency attainment programs, and then also increasing our forensic navigators' caseload capacity and our ability to efficiently operate our or support our operational structures. So this slide just gives you a picture of where we are right now. Over this last year, we've created additional policies and procedures to support our work. We've been able to establish independent financial processing systems, so we are no longer reliant on other state agencies or judicial branch agencies to provide that for us. We've also established an evidence-based salary and compensation structure for our employees. We currently have 42 forensic navigators on board, 13 of which have just started in the last couple of months, and we're very excited to have them here. They're very excited also. We have navigators assigned in 2,292 cases throughout the state. That represents assistance to 942 defendants, and we are assigned in cases in 80 out of the 87 counties in Minnesota. And we now have 13 certified competency attainment programs, and just a little over a month ago, the first jail-based program was certified by the board.
Yes. Ms. Larson, if I can interrupt you. Where is that program based, the first jail-based program? Is that Hennepin County or?
Stearns County.
Stearns, okay, thank you.
You're welcome, thank you, Chair. All right, so the next slide, 7, is just a picture of the hiring that we've done over the last year. broken down by quarter. The critical piece of information to share here is that we do currently have the forensic navigator position posted. We're accepting applications. We expect to start the interview process in a couple of weeks, and our goal is to hire up to 15 to 20 more by the end of this fiscal year. Just a quick summary of what forensic navigators do. Most of these duties are, well, all of these duties are set out in one way or another in the enabling statute. Their primary role is to write and file bridge plans for the court, also to provide progress reports to the court and the parties. Progress reports let those individuals know how the defendant is progressing through their attempts at attaining competency. They also coordinate directly with defendants, with their family members, and with other partners who are assisting the defendants to make sure that they're getting the services or the placements that they need in different programs. So this next slide shows you where, not as visually interesting probably as what we were able to do last year, because we have too many employees now to just put a little star on the map for where they all reside. But this just gives you a picture of where or which judicial districts each of our forensic navigators reside in throughout Minnesota. I do want to note we have two employees who are Wisconsin residents, so they are included in the number for the district that's closest to where they live. And the other thing to note is, although this is, I think, interesting and instructive, it doesn't say a whole lot about how we meet the needs statewide. We do have most, if not all, of our forensic navigators assigned in cases across district lines. So even though they reside in one district, they don't only work on cases in that district. We want to make sure that we get the broadest coverage possible. And so when it's a reasonable distance from where they reside, we do assign them across district lines. So this next slide just gives you a picture of just sheer numbers. The bottom table is the data that was provided during last year's session. The top table shows where we are as of the end of calendar year 2025. So we've received over 9,000 cases from the court, orders from the court. That represents about 4,500 defendants. So many defendants have multiple cases. That's why you don't see a one-for-one match in those numbers. And we've received orders from 84 of the 87 counties in Minnesota. And the other information about assignments I gave you on an earlier slide. So this slide gives you a look at more numbers by district. So that middle column, orders by the court, those are numbers that were provided to us by the State Court Administrator's Office. It's what they collect in their case management system, and it reflects the total number of times that a competency exam was ordered in 2025. The column on the right shows the number of orders that MNCAB received from each of those districts. A good thing to keep in mind here, similar to what I just said about how cases and defendants are not one-to-one, that's why these numbers also are not one-to-one, and we don't expect they ever would be, because the total number of competency exams counts every time a new exam was ordered for a single defendant in a single case. So we won't ever have a pure match in this data. Excuse me. This slide is just meant to give you a picture of coverage, so percentage of coverage around the state. It's laid out by district, and again, I provided both case and defendant because of that not having a one-for-one match. So I wanted to just give you a picture of what coverage looks like based on the number of cases, and then what it looks like based on the number of defendants in those districts. Yes, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Just a question on the previous slide. Just curious, I just want some clarification. If there is someone that is having to be evaluated for competency, but they've got multiple cases open, there's one evaluation for all of those cases. Is that correct?
Not always. So it will depend on timing of when the case was opened. So you might have one case that was charged, competency exam was ordered, and a few months later they're charged with another offense. Mm-hmm. That first case is still open. They order another exam in that second case. They could have an open case in another county or another district, and that judge in that area may order another exam. I know in my some recent conversations with our partners at the State Court Administrator's Office, they are exploring ways to utilize same exams in a close period of time in multiple cases, if all of that falls into place. We do have a couple of examples where our navigator was able to inform another court that a recent exam was completed in another case, and the courts did make arrangements to utilize that exam in the new case. We don't always catch all of those instances, but when we do, we try to make sure the parties know about it and that the court knows so that they can decide if it's appropriate to use the same report for multiple cases.
Right. Thank you for that clarification, because I know, isn't there kind of a shortage of people to do these exams in the first place? And any time that we can consolidate some of that would be beneficial for just not just for cost savings, but for the time that it takes. So
correct.
Yeah, and effort. Yes. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, go ahead. Thank you, Chair Scott. All right, so we talked about coverage. So I'm going to move on to a little bit of information about competency attainment programs. This slide just gives you a picture, shows you the names of all of the programs that are currently certified and where they're located. If you have an electronic version of the presentation, that link to our website should be live if you're interested and you want to go look at more details about each of those programs. excuse me, along with certified programs is a very critical component, which is the curriculum or the defendant workbook. The statute defines competency attainment services as the education that is related to helping the defendant make sure they understand court processes and can effectively participate in their case. So education is another part of that competency process. The board published the first defendant workbook in September of 2024. Our team has spent the last year going through it, revising it to try to make it more plain language and accessible to different learning styles and abilities. We have some continued work to do on that. We plan to build it out and create resources that people can use, learning aids like flashcards, handouts, and that kind of thing. And we do plan to also launch a kind of a train-the-trainer type program. So as individuals or programs are interested in delivering competency attainment education, we'll have an expert on staff who can walk them through the workbook and help them understand what's needed to be delivered when that education is provided to defendants. And then finally, just a couple other data points to share with you about competency attainment services. We've over 50 of the defendants that forensic navigators work with have participated in programming at one of the 13 certified competency attainment programs. And then forensic navigators themselves have delivered competency attainment education to around 20 defendants. And so far we're seeing, thankfully, some good success with that.
Ms. Larson, yes. How long does it take to go through that curriculum or that education piece?
Yeah, Chair Scott, it really varies depending on the defendant. So one of the examples in the handout that I gave you that shares a couple of stories of our work with defendants, one of our forensic navigators met with that defendant for an hour every day for 4 weeks, and ultimately then at the next competency exam, the court found them competent. So that's just one example. Some individuals don't need that long. Some don't ever really successfully complete the education, and that right takes us down a whole different path of whether or not they can actually attain competency or not. So it really varies. The certified programs provide education in different types of settings also. So some will provide it one-on-one. And then the frequency depends on the needs of that individual. Some of them do it in small group settings, and so then they have a more structured process. So it might be like once a week, the small group meets and they go through a portion of the workbook. We are just getting ready to start collecting that data from the certified programs to know more about how that's working in their systems.
Thank you. And then let's say a forensic navigator is working with someone and it just seems like there's probably not a pathway for competency. How is that handled? What's the chain of command?
Yeah, the way we've seen it play out so far is either one of the attorneys, the county attorney or the defense attorney, are bringing a motion before the court to say, here's all the things that have been done, here's how long we've been attempting to help this defendant attain competency. We're not making progress. We don't think it's feasible. And then the court either holds a hearing, collects information, whatever they need to try to make that assessment, and then they're making a determination. When they have, I'm not aware of a lot of cases, but I believe there have been at least a few where the court has determined the individual is not likely to attain competency. And most often then their case is being dismissed. What we do with our forensic navigators is we try to make sure that defendant is still connected with services, because they're still gonna need assistance of one type or another. And then we try to make sure that those services they have are set up long-term. So once the case is dismissed and we're no longer helping them, all of their supports don't fall out from underneath them. So we spend about an extra 90 days or so after that, or after a case closes, regardless of the reason, mm-hmm. to just make sure that those services are shored up, that they're set, and that we feel confident the defendant has what they need to maintain stability or keep moving towards stability.
Okay, thank you. Chair Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. So, hearing about the competency attainment itself and the education, I feel like it maybe doesn't give a full picture of what your office does, although I don't feel like I have a really full picture of what the office does. So when you're competency attainment, the education piece, that's just kind of the end thing, right? Because a lot of the people coming in need the other services that you're now talking about. So if people have mental health issues, am I correct that the forensic navigators get involved in helping make sure they get guided to those services also, right? So it isn't all about the competency education itself. It's about getting people even to a position where they can have that education.
Yes.
Ms. Larson.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. That's absolutely right. So very... that's why you see only like 20 defendants that we've done education services with. The first thing we do when we assign a forensic navigator to a case is they spend the first couple of weeks trying to figure out what the situation is for that defendant. Do they have any current services set up? Are they serviceless? Have they had any assessments completed? What are their diagnoses? Trying to just wrap our arms around what the needs of that individual defendant is. Then the first thing we focus on is stability, is kind of what I call it. So that could be just basic needs. Do they have housing? Do they have access to food? Do they need referrals to get those basic needs met? Then once that's in place, and I shouldn't say it like it's so clearly step by step, because sometimes things overlap and we work on different things in parallel. But then we'll look at, do they need mental health services? Do they need substance use treatment? Are there cognitive impairments? And then once somebody is relatively stabilized, that's when we look at whether or not they need the education component. Not every defendant will need the education component. A lot of people, once they're on regular medications and their life is stabilized and they have some of that structure and security, they can understand the court processes and everything that goes along with that. So we do an initial kind of assessment there, like, is education something they need? And if it is, and there's nobody else to deliver it, our forensic navigators will. But if they don't, then we tend to not spend time on that component.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. And so, you know, looking at the data that you've given us, which, you know, it's great to see that the office is growing and you've had all the success bringing a lot of these folks on board, but I'm wondering, is there going to be any way for us to evaluate the success of the program other than with just sheer numbers served and cases picked up and numbers served, like the success of the process that you were just describing of, I don't know how, do we have a built-in way to evaluate and track how successful we are with actually getting people stabilized and so on?
Ms. Larson.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Thank you for the question, Chair Liebling. That's a really hard question to answer. It's a balance of, I think, quantitative versus qualitative information. Right now, we're struggling even to collect all of the quantitative data that we need to be able to kind of look at. We have these numbers, but what do they really mean, right? So we don't quite have that ability yet to sort of drill down and see even successes in the quantitative data yet. The qualitative side of it is, I think, where we hope to get is to be able to eventually say, this many defendants participated in certified competency attainment programs, and of those, I don't know, 80% attained competency and were found competent at some point. We don't have the ability to tell those stories yet, but I think that's where we need to get in order to see that true success, which is which types of services are most effective. When somebody gets involved in different types of services, is it a like a faster path towards competency versus some other path? Hopefully we'll be able to also tell the story about where or if disruptions in their progress occur and what's the cause of that disruption. Is it their own like decision to stop taking medications? Or is it that they were not financially eligible for a critical service that they needed to keep moving forward? And I think that's kind of the information that we need to get at big picture to see what truly is successful in the support of forensic navigators in this work versus kind of maybe things that aren't as important or successful and will set a path for us as the years progress.
Chairlady,
that help?
Yeah, it does. And thanks. I think this is really important. You know, I wasn't on the committee when the Competency Attainment Board was set up. And so I don't know the conversation there. But I'd be really interested in knowing, is there an impact on, say, recidivism? And I realize these things can be hard to track and it's hard to assign causes to things, but there was a set of real concerns that resulted in the creation of this board, which is, you know, quite frankly, it's an expensive venture for the state to set up this new board and hire all these new people and ongoing. And so I think it would be helpful to figure out some way to measure the impact on the original problem that it was meant to solve, which I think was in part recidivism. It was, maybe you could tell us rather than me talking about something that I wasn't here for, like what was the original problem? Because I'd really like to ultimately be able to see, are we really addressing that problem? Not just creating a new agency and growing it because, you know, it sounds good or whatever, which I'm not saying that that's what's happening, but you know what I mean.
I think there were some gaps that were happening back in the day, but go ahead, Ms. Larson.
Yes, thank you. The original impetus, my understanding, was what is referred to as gap cases in Minnesota. So it was those individuals who were found incompetent in the criminal court but were not civilly committable. And those are two different criteria. So civil commitment is really an imminent threat to themselves or others, and not every person who's incompetent is in that state. Courts were releasing defendants from custody who were incompetent but not civilly committable. There were some instances in the state of Minnesota where a few of those individuals then went on to commit further violent crimes during that time frame. They weren't getting services, they weren't in treatment, they weren't really connected to the court in any way. The court didn't really have avenues for monitoring or supervising what was happening with them in that stage. And so my understanding is that is primarily what was the impetus of creating the forensic navigator position and the competency attainment board, was to be able to have one, an entity, an individual who could provide that monitoring and assistance and make sure services were provided to that defendant who was in a gap case situation, so that they were hopefully progressing in treating their mental illness, their substance use issues, and working towards attaining competency. Part of what I think we all hope gets at the recidivism piece that you're talking about. We do know there's some data that I don't have at hand, but it tells us, especially with those low-level misdemeanor offenses and sometimes targeted misdemeanor offenses, there are individuals due to their mental illness or other issues where they just cycle through the court system because they're, you know, the minor trespassing in a store or, you know, shoplifting a candy bar or something like that, and they just keep cycling through. I think, excuse me, the hope is that if we can help those individuals treat their mental illnesses and whatever co-occurring disorders may be going on with them, help them become stable in the community, then that cycle of low-level offenses will stop, and that will keep them out of the justice system. So it's more like a diversion or prevention maybe than necessarily a recidivism, and they kind of go hand in hand, but we definitely think of that as another purpose for us. And I also think that's part of why there's a component in the new statute built in for misdemeanors that gives the court the ability to just dismiss the case if the public interest, if it's within the public interest, or if that individual is found incompetent. So there is some ability for the court to kind of manage how they get those cases in front of them as well. And sometimes the work that our navigators do is to remind the parties and the court that that option exists, and, you know, try to reduce justice system involvement that way as well. Chairman, I think I answered a little more than you asked.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that. Yeah. I have two people on the list, Representative Duran and Representative Rarick. Do either one of you want to address this specific answer? Okay, Representative Rarick, and then we'll let you finish your presentation since you're almost done, then we'll open it up for our questions.
Thank you, Madam Chairs, both. So this is a direct result of a tragedy, a preventable tragedy in my district that cost somebody their life. This was the Alina Clinic shooting. Happened in February. Here we are. The anniversary was just a few days ago. So I'll just call him the gentleman. Had a harassment restraining order out against him. The court found him incompetent to stand trial. He immediately, well, I should say this. So he had the harassment restraining order against him so that it was protecting a particular doctor in that clinic. He immediately violated that, which was a misdemeanor. Then that misdemeanor came before Buffalo City attorney, essentially, and they did an evaluation. They found him to be incompetent to stand trial, and that city attorney dismissed the case. He went on to just do an absolute rampage against anybody and everybody, including the mayor's granddaughter was in the clinic the day before, as was my grandchildren had been in that clinic in the previous week. Anyway, so he brought in loaded guns and explosive devices, which he shot five people, exploded devices, killed one person. It's a literal miracle that all five didn't die. And the clinic took evasive maneuvers very, very quickly, and law enforcement was on the scene immediately. And I have to give credit to my own sheriff, who went in an unsecured scene and went in to look for victims himself. So that this is a direct result of that. And I had drafted some legislation to get at this massive hole, which is that you were allowed to just dismiss without any follow-up whatsoever, without any help, without any even a conversation about civil commitment, absolutely nothing. So this man now is serving time, but it could have easily been avoided because his record was clean because the misdemeanor was dismissed, and he was able to legally purchase a gun. So this is one, there's many cases after this, but this is one of the worst cases in the state of Minnesota resulting in this. And so I would actually really, really like to hear, what are we doing about folks like that gentleman that took one of the lives of one of my constituents and shot and permanently traumatized the entire Allina Health team. And I would note, too, that even the helicopters that arrived to take people away, the life flight, were connected to those that were shot. There was connections there. So the whole community was shocked, and there was a manhunt for a good while. They thought that he had maybe left devices elsewhere within the city. So it was almost like the whole city was in lockdown. Yeah. So anyway, I would love to have that not ever happen at the state of Minnesota again, and this is supposed to get at that.
Yeah. And Representative Rikers, I remember too, and I don't know if Chair Liebling can recollect any of this, but these folks that kind of were falling into those gaps, HHS used to have a program to keep kind of track of them and help them with services, and they just like, Ms. Larson is shaking her head, yeah, they like decided all of a sudden they weren't going to do that anymore. So I don't know, Ms. Larson, if you want to, you know, speak to Representative Rarick's comments and the ones I just made, but that'll give members, especially new members, a little bit more of a history lesson here.
Yeah, of course. Thank you, Chair Scott. Thank you, Representative. Yes, in fact, when I made my comments about tragic incidents, that situation you described is exactly what I was thinking of, and recollecting that just a few days ago was the anniversary of that. That's why we're here, right? We're trying to make sure that there's somebody who's aware of what individuals like that gentleman, what they're doing when they're released, and making sure that, or hopefully, right, engaging them in services, getting them connected to mental health treatment or whatever it is they need. And if they're not willing to do that, making sure the court and the parties know that they're not participating and that it's not going well. So that's what we're doing right now. My hope is as we have more forensic navigators on board and we're able to, part of the difficulty right now is we don't have resources to connect with all of those individuals. So we're still at the point where we're trying to have enough people that we are working with everyone who's in that situation. I feel really confident that the people we are working with, our forensic navigators, are doing everything they can to connect them to services and make sure that they don't end up in a situation like you were just sharing with us. I hope that all the information we're able to collect over time will be able to tell the story of how we've accomplished that and prevented another incident like that happening in our state. I know I'm talking still a little bit about hope because we are still in that like growing stage to get to that point. But I have the utmost confidence in our employees, and I know that they're just as committed to doing this work as I am, and we'll do our best to hopefully achieve that complete outcome. Chair Scott, your question about DHS ceasing services, That did occur in around 2017 and 2018. They had at least two residential or hospital-based programs that provided competency restoration services at the time to individuals in that situation. They, what they shifted was the point, my understanding anyway, is the point in time at which they would release them from that programming. And so they would kind of get them to a stability point and then release them from the program and would not work them all the way through attainment of competency. So it was kind of the same situation where you might have had someone in jail who was released then to the community. It was a similar gap type, just coming out of a different type of facility than an in-custody facility. And they are now providing competency attainment services at Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center under this new statute, and they're working towards growing their capacity to meet, to serve more defendants.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Why don't you go ahead and finish your presentation, then we have some member questions, and so go ahead. Thank you.
So the last point I want to make, the statute does say that the board is authorized to bring forward legislative or rule changes as they feel it might be helpful to our continued growth. So this slide just gives you a look at some policy language that we are hoping to bring forward in this session. I didn't plan to talk about it in detail, but I'm happy to answer questions if anybody has any. And then finally, at the end, I want to just wrap up by letting this committee know that the Competency Attainment Board, I mean, you've heard it today, we've experienced tremendous growth over the last year. With that, we've made great progress. It's sometimes hard to recognize the progress when you're in it day to day, and it's often really small and incremental. When we are able to notice it is when we get those expressions of gratitude and thanks from the people that we're working with. So defendants express their gratitude to forensic navigators on a regular basis. Family members do. County or attorney partners thank us frequently, and the courts do as well. You do have the handout with just a couple, three defendant stories to give you an idea of what is going on. We have a lot more, yeah, thank you, that we are trying to document and put together kind of a full picture story of some of the scenarios that we've encountered. So if this committee is interested in seeing more, I'm happy to share those with you. And with that, I complete my presentation. I'm happy to take your questions.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. You've been very accommodating to our questions so far. We will go to Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I really appreciate this. I've got a couple things. You're court mandated, right?
Yes. Ms. Larson.
Okay.
Go ahead. Representative Duran.
Sorry.
It's for the tape.
Yeah. What happens if someone doesn't follow your guys' directions or guidance, or what happens then?
Ms. Larson.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Thanks for the question. So we'll continue to try to keep engaging them. We can't force them to do it. So what we do is we'll report to the court and to the attorneys on the case the level of the individual's engagement. If they're not engaging at all, we'll let the court know that. Some courts will then look to the conditions of release, and if that failure to cooperate means that they violated conditions of release, the court may consider bringing them back into custody or whatever else they might sanction against that individual for not cooperating. Beyond that, that's the avenue that we have to try to manage that. So we always start by continuing to reach out and try different ways to get them to engage, but we also just keep the court and the parties informed of how that's going.
Representative Duran.
Yep. Thank you for that. I guess, is there anything, I guess, in the legislation that we should look at to maybe assist you in that effort? Is there anything that maybe we should look at, or
You mean like process-wise? Or
process-wise,
like
yeah.
Ms. Larson?
Thank you, Chair Scott. That's a great question, and I'm not sure I have a good answer to it today. Part of the maybe things that makes that a little bit difficult, and it's one of the things we addressed actually in a legislative change last session, is we are not law enforcement, and so we don't have the same authority that like a probation officer or a pretrial services individual or law enforcement agent would have. I think if you're talking about someone in the criminal justice system who's not complying with a court order, really that's where your first thought goes, is what like legal authority do we have to force them to comply? And that isn't really what our role is in the overall system. So I think I would like to say, I'd like to think about your question a little bit more and maybe get back to you at a later point if that would be acceptable.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Representative Duran?
Just, yes, a couple more questions here. I'll be short, hopefully. So are all your clients that you usually get, are they involved in social services as well at the same time?
Ms. Larson.
Thank you. The majority of them are, not all of them. So some defendants, when we start working with them, they don't have any supports in place. We may not even know if they're eligible for services. So the first place that we would start in that instance is trying to get them a diagnostic assessment or some other kind of MN Choices assessment done so that we know what their needs are and what services they're eligible for. That often will lead to then a relationship and the ability to get services from a county agency. So our forensic navigators then would help that individual make those connections, maybe fill out applications if they need to do that and get those services set up. Some defendants we work with, yes, they do have all of those services in place when we start. And so then we're just starting from a different spot. We're connecting with that social services agency, trying to find out a little of the history or the current situation of the defendant. And then we work collaboratively with that agency to make sure the defendant is continuing to participate, and or if there are additional needs they have, we can help make those connections and hopefully get them into other programs or services if that's what they need. So it really depends on the situation of each defendant.
Representative Duran, if you have future questions, I'm going to have you contact her directly or see her otherwise. We have three more people on the list, and we have to move on to another presentation shortly. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Larson. I want to start with on page 10, because you kept making the point as we were going through this data that there's a reason for a lack of one-to-one comparison, but in two different columns of numbers. On page 10, I'm having difficulty understanding that disparity because, for instance, just looking at cases in 2026, 9,273, but assignments 2,292. Can you provide some more context into what explains that disparity?
Ms. Larson.
Thank you, Chair Scott. I want to make sure I'm looking at the right. So is this the data you're looking at?
No, page 10.
This one?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, I think if I understand your question correctly, so the first issue with the data that I'm providing is that one-for-one issue. So it isn't one case, one defendant. So we'll always see a higher number of cases than we will a number of defendants. So that's where that first piece comes from. The second piece, I think, is to answer your question, is to the coverage numbers that I provided. So we just don't have enough forensic navigators right now to assign someone in every case that we receive an order in. So what the mismatch in those numbers is what you see between our capacity for assigning a forensic navigator and then the cases we've received orders on, but we haven't been able to assign somebody in yet.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Larson. So it would seem then that the even though the order's been issued, the fact that you don't have the bandwidth to handle all the orders, it doesn't create any sort of problem for your agency other than not being able to serve people who need to be served. Is that an accurate characterization?
Ms. Larson.
Thank you, Chair Scott. I wouldn't say it causes a problem per se, other than we really want to help more people, and it's, you know, just getting there. What we are seeing is around the state are local partners getting together and figuring out how to effectively implement some of the strategies in Statute 611, even when a forensic navigator might not be assigned to a case. In fact, there's a summit coming up the first week of March where 150 or more people from around the state are coming together specifically to talk about strategies on how to do that in their local courts and try to make sure that somebody is there to connect services and sort of fill those gaps until we have enough capacity to serve everyone. So I think the problem is more like on the system side than necessarily for our particular agency.
Representative Hudson.
And very, very quickly, because I know there's other people who have questions, can you describe what you're observing in terms of the incentive for defendants to participate in this process? Because if they attain competency, well, now they've got to have their day in court. So how does that work?
Ms. Larson.
Thank you. Yes, that is a hard question to answer, and it's been a main question from the beginning. What the perspective I take on that is the incentive is hopefully to gain stability, wellness, and participate in their community and not be struggling to either meet daily needs or manage their mental health. The reality is they've been charged with a crime, and that ultimately is going to be an outcome of them attaining competency. There's no getting around that, but the first and foremost, it's for us that wellness component, for lack of a better shortcutting the term. But then also, right, we have a responsibility to the courts to help them resolve these cases, and that's the other reason why we're there. So it may not be an incentive specifically for every defendant, although it is for some. Some want to, right, close out their case, not be dealing with that anymore. It's just kind of a juggling reality of the nature of what we're doing.
Representative Finke and then Representative Feist, you'll get the last question unless somebody else. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you. Go ahead, Representative Finke.
I just have one question, right, about the gap case, the system that brought this, right? You have a gap case, you have a defendant, they're not civilly commutable, and the attainment board's job is to determine whether or not that person, like at the end of all the program, they're either able to stand trial or not competent or go to court, right? These are your two options. Do you also have in the process, can you shift someone to the other side and say, this person is not competent to stand trial and should be civilly committed? Can you do that part?
Ms. Larson.
Thank you. I love that question, and yes, we can. So the first thing I'll just note, though, is we are never the final decision maker in whether or not somebody is competent or not. So if we think that status has changed for a defendant, we'll let the parties know, we'll let the court know, and then it's up to the court to order a new examination, and then you have a forensic examiner looking at that. They give an opinion to the court on competency or not, and the court decides yes, they are, or no, they aren't. If we're working with someone and we think that civil commitment needs to be considered because either their situation has changed or it just didn't come up the first time, we will also make that recommendation to the court. So we have put recommendations in bridge plans and progress reports that the court maybe should consider a referral for civil commitment evaluation.
Yep. All right. Representative Feist, and then we'll go to Representative Inkin. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two quick questions. The first one's kind of a question slash recommendation. I noticed that Pine County was one of your examples,
yes.
And I know that Pine County is like award-winning in terms of their restorative justice work, and they took advantage of the recent restorative practices grants and hired a restorative practices coordinator. And so I was just curious, you know, restorative practices are kind of doing some aligned work around looking at underlying factors that lead somebody to cause harm, how to create accountability and reduce recidivism. And so I was just curious, are you coordinating with the Office of Restorative Practices and with people who have received this funding across the state?
Ms. Larson.
Thank you, Chair Scott. That's a great question, and I have to say, no, we're not. I'm not overly familiar with that program, so I just wrote it down so when I get back to the office, I can look it up. But that's exactly the type of partner we would want to be connecting with, so I appreciate you mentioning it.
Amazing. Representative Weiss, way to go.
Yay, thank you. I will also follow up with you just to make some quick introductions, because I think there's a lot of opportunities here. So thank you. And then my other quick question was just, are the forensic navigators trained in extreme risk protection orders?
Ms. Larson.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Excellent question. Not specifically, but we, at this stage, we do like overarching education, but we don't have a deep dive into that specific topic yet at this point.
Representative Feist.
Yep, thank you. I would recommend it strongly. Thank you.
All right, Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the overview here. Couple quick questions. What is MNCAP's process for determining program certification and eligibility? Could you walk me through that a little bit?
Ms. Larson.
Thank you. Yes, I can. So there are interim procedures that the board adopted that are published on our website. There is information also in the statute that says what a certification or a competency attainment program standards, what standards they have to meet in order to be certified. So the first step is a program that's interested in certification fills out an application. The application essentially asks them to document all of the things that are set forth in the statute, plus a few other items like their licensure, if they have that, and a few other things. The board then, or we have an employee who reviews those applications. If there are questions or gaps, we reach out and try to fill them. Once it's ready, it goes to the board. At one of their board meetings, they review it collectively, have a discussion, and then they make a decision on approval or non-approval.
Thank you. Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That may present some inherent conflicts of interest if the board is determining that, but I'll move on. What oversight measures or verification checks do you guys have in place to ensure that the programs and those that you guys are certifying as eligible are not amongst those that have been in housing stabilization, behavioral health, SUD treatment, that have been subject to fraudulent behavior, seeing as DHS is also licensing those programs that you guys are then adopting and certified?
Ms. Larson.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Thank you for the question. We are not a licensing entity, and so we rely on what we see as the status of that individual program's licensing through the entities that are responsible for that. What we are working towards is establishing what I would call a complaint process. So if an individual who's participating in a program with one of the certified programs has a complaint, they can send that to us, and we will, I don't want to speak in detail because it's not fully developed yet, but we intend to put a process in place where we see what those complaints are. If it's related to licensing, we will refer to the appropriate licensing board. If it's related to the work that we're responsible for overseeing, then we will address it through the board's avenues. Did that get at what you were wondering about?
Representative Engen.
Not entirely, no, but we can talk offline and we can try to work on that as a legislature as well. Program integrity needs to be paramount if we're going to be growing out this entire system. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Ms. Larson, for a very thorough discussion. Thank you, members, for being engaged in this. It's really important work that they're doing, and we look forward to future updates. So thank you, Ms. Larson. With that, we will invite Alex Miller with the Guardian Ad Litem Board to come forward. Thank you for joining us today. And as soon as you get settled there, go ahead and introduce yourself and go ahead with your presentation.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, I may need just a little guidance on how I
Thank you. Yep, we have a page that will come and help you.
Yes, I do. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you much for having me here. My name's Alex Miller. I'm the interim program administrator of the Guardian Ad Litem program. I was appointed in September of 2025. I've been with the Guardian Ad Litem program for about 27 years now in various capacities. I understand the committee is most interested in our progress with the volunteer program since last session, and we have a lot of, I think, exciting information to share with you. So. I'll just jump right in if that's. In 2025, we had one district that had volunteers. That was Hennepin. There's an asterisk in your material because we did have one guardian ad litem volunteer in Hennepin. In Ramsey County. We had one supervisor for volunteers, and we had onboarded no volunteers in the preceding fiscal year. So we'd had no. Or the first preceding calendar year. So we'd had no new volunteers in the preceding year. We had 13 active volunteers. There was actually a mistake in the materials I forwarded to the committee. There we had 5 volunteers that I didn't find on a search because they had a null start date in our system. Today we have volunteer programs in 3 judicial districts. So the 4th Judicial District, the 10th Judicial District, and the 2nd. We have 3 volunteer supervisors. 2 of those supervisors were hired with funding that the legislature provided last year. We've onboarded 47 volunteers over the course of the year, most of that starting after June of 2025 because we had to get the supervisors on board and those folks trained in. And we currently have 52 active volunteers. So we've made incredible progress in a short period of time standing up.
Mr. Miller, thank you. I'm just so heartened by this information. Smiling ear to ear. Thank you. Go ahead.
And if I may, I think I probably should back up just a little bit and orient folks to the program itself. I did want to stress the progress that we've made. The Guardian Ad Litem Board is a semi-independent board under the judicial branch. Our enabling legislation is 480.35. We represent children in child abuse and neglect cases pursuant to 260C. So we're mandated appointments to represent the best interests of children in child abuse and neglect cases. We are mandated in some family court cases pursuant to 518.165. Those are cases in which the court makes a determination that a guardian ad litem is in the best interest of the child. Our role is to advocate for the best interest of the child throughout the child protection case, the family court case, make periodic recommendations to the court about the interim safety and well-being of the child, and often regarding permanency recommendations. So when the child protection case reaches a point where a decision has to be made, whether there should be reunification of the child with family, adoption, or some placement outside of the home, we make recommendations in those instances as well. We have essentially within the program three divisions. You might call it a juvenile division, which represents all of those cases in 260C. We have an ICWA division, which represents children in ICWA and MIFPA cases. ICWA is the Indian Child Welfare Act. And we have a family court division that represents the best interests of children and makes recommendations to the court in family court cases. Currently, we have about 3,000, a little over 3,000 cases assigned today total. 2,900 of those are juvenile cases, 459 of those are ICWA cases, and the remainder of the caseload is family. To give you an idea of the scope of work being done by Guardians Ad Litem, we have 226 Guardian Ad Litem employees and, as I said, 52 volunteers. In March, we have 1,400 hearings scheduled in cases that Guardians Ad Litem will attend. Many of those will require court reports. In January of 2026, our staff filed 968 court reports. We have also a significant amount of trial work in the last 11 months. We had over 1,000 days of trial program-wide that our Guardians Ad Litem attended. So that gives you an idea of the scope of the program.
Mr. Miller, thank you for that data. It's not in our packets, but I know I'm interested in having that in writing. If you could forward that to us.
Absolutely.
That would be great. Thank you. Go ahead.
Our current volunteer presence, we have 52 volunteers with 52 cases assigned. That's about 1.7% of our total caseload. We have 95 children assigned to volunteer guardians, which is about 2%. Those volunteers have filed 257 court reports in the last year, and in the last 120 days made 360 in-person child contacts with their children that they represent. Our 2026 plan is to bring on two more cohorts in April and June of 2026. And to have 100 active volunteers by July 1st of 2026. This was the board's target. We have some challenges that we're acknowledging and working through and learning from as we onboard these cohorts of volunteers. One is that bringing on 100 new Guardians Ad Litem represents a 44% increase in the persons that we have to support. So this is technology support, HR support, all of the things, training support, all of the things that allow them to be successful Guardian Ad Litem volunteers. We also need to look at the early attrition that we're seeing. So with the cohorts that we've onboarded in 2025, we have about a 15% attrition rate, which is actually quite good if you look at retention of volunteers. There's some literature that from National CASAs that suggests that rate may vary between 30 and 60%. We're currently well below that. But we have to be mindful of that attrition rate because it affects our recruiting. We have to consider, if we have a target of how many folks we want as volunteers, we have to consider that we're going to be losing a percentage of those folks over the course of the year and plan accordingly. In that regard, we work closely with Minnesota CASA. So Minnesota CASA is an organization of volunteers who is willing to provide support for volunteers and to assist in the recruiting of volunteers as well. And we've worked closely with them. I know that they've been present and active legislatively in years past. We meet once a month. The program deputy and I meet once a month with the MnCASA president, and we talk about areas where we can work together to support volunteers and recruit volunteers. We also need to be mindful as we move forward building out that volunteer program of the National CASA Supervisory Ratio Guidelines. The Supervisory Ratio Guidelines are 30 volunteers to a supervisor, which makes sense to provide adequate support for the volunteers to ensure quality throughout the program. And as we build out and have more and more volunteers, that ratio will need to consider additional supervisors. Technology and training for our volunteers is another important piece that we're learning about as we move forward, and I'll talk about that in a minute in some more detail. And then we have additional HR support requirements that we have to be mindful of. Our HR team is involved in recruiting, interviewing, and supporting the volunteers throughout, as is our training staff. And again, 100 additional persons, which we'll hopefully be at in July, will require significant additional resources on the part of the program.
Mr. Miller, I have a question. Are some of the folks that have been recruited into the volunteer program, were they past volunteers and they've come back, or are you seeing any of that?
It's an excellent question. Not past volunteers, but past employees. So we have one employee who came back after a period of, I want to say, 18 months to 2 years. And then recently, two employees who left the program and then immediately converted to volunteer. So they retained one or two of their cases as after they left as an employee. Some of the lessons that we've learned over the last 4 or 5 months as we've implemented the program, one is that we need to use more directly and mindfully in-person cohorts as we onboard the volunteers. We have a learning management system, and we have much of our training in the learning management system. But we found with the volunteers that we need to have the volunteers in person and train them as a group in the beginning of their tenure. And so we've been doing that. The other is that we have to provide a more extended learning path for volunteers, and we're actually looking at this for employees as well. The idea here is to provide them just-in-time information for their tasks. A volunteer will take one or two cases. And depending on when they are assigned to that case, it may be months or longer before they ever have a hearing or before they have to do a court report. So if you provide that volunteer onboarding training at day one and then they're not seeing a court report until day 90, I think all of you can appreciate that much of that knowledge is lost and their advocacy is not effective. So we're looking at extending the learning path out to accommodate the volunteers and make sure that they're receiving the training when they need it. And that's also designed to increase retention. Obviously, the more guardians feel supported, the more knowledgeable they feel they are. The more they're likely to be retained in the program. Likewise, frequent support from their supervisors and opportunities for peer discussion between guardian ad litem volunteers and employees. So those groups are meeting together in district in brown bags, consultations, and other sessions so that the guardians ad litem have the experience and the benefit of associating with their peer employees who handle far more cases than they do. And then finally, on the technology side, we're moving to virtual desktop for all of our volunteers. So this is for their ease of use and for security. So the idea here is very simple. They just have a web connection. They go out to their virtual desktop. Their email application is there. Their access to our case management system is there. All of their documents will be stored and retained there, which allows us to make sure that we have a secure system and allows them not to have to worry about technology as a barrier to being a volunteer. Perhaps I should stop, Madam Chair, there, because I have the remainder of the presentation pivots to some other issues and other progress with the program. I didn't know if there might be questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So very good. Thank you for being here today and the work that you're doing. Question on volunteers. Is there any specific background that they have to have or work experience? And then if not, what does training look like and how long is the training that you provide?
Mr. Miller.
There isn't a specific background that they have to have in order to be a volunteer. The training that the guardians ad litem go through is initially our standard guardian ad litem program 40-hour training. So those are modules that deal with a variety of issues, child development, understanding the court system, chemical dependency, mental health, just the standard guardian ad litem curriculum. They also have access to additional learning opportunities from our legal team. So our legal team provides support to all of our staff through Friday trainings, usually once a month. Those topics include a variety of more detailed legal issues, and also provides guidance on the things like oral presentation in court, trial testimony, tips and techniques, things like that.
Follow up? Okay, very good. Please continue. No other questions at this time, so go ahead.
So in addition to the volunteers, another, I think, tremendous area of success for the program is the reduction in our unassigned cases, particularly in Hennepin County, and perhaps members of the committee have heard about this unassigned cases in Hennepin over the year. In 2025, the monthly average of unassigned cases statewide was 201 unassigned cases, which represented roughly 7% of cases in children. Today, that unassigned case list is 53. So it's a 74% reduction in unassigned cases since roughly June of this year, of the past year, I'm sorry, June of 2025. The current list is represents about 2% of cases in children. We dashboard this in real time on our website, so I'll just... It doesn't seem to be picking up the...
We will see if the page can help you. Otherwise, members were emailed the link in their packet.
The link in the presentation works.
There we go.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The link in the PowerPoint and PDF that I provided to the committee will take you to the website and to this dashboard. And this is where we dashboard in real time unassigned children and cases for the program. This is updated daily, and it's updated from a report that feeds directly from our case management system database and then is pulled out to the website. This is... In the presentation where I remarked that there's sort of no exceptions in the data, this is what I'm referring to. This represents just today's status as is. Many of these cases are cases that we may have received in the last couple of days. They're not cases that have been lingering for a long time, but we just represent them so that everyone has a full picture of where we're at in terms of our assignments on any given day. In addition, over that period, we've seen a 20% increase in timely court reports and child contacts. That's in Hennepin County between September of 2025 and December of 2025. Much of that is attributable to the decrease in unassigned cases, but additionally to the great work that is being done in Hennepin in terms of training and supporting staff and ensuring that they're that they're attentive to the court reports. The remainder of my presentation would be to review the annual report, which I sent to the committee. Would that?
Please go ahead and cover it if you'd like.
The report, last year the statute was amended to require the guardian ad litem to report on a number of factors over the course of the year. One is the total number of paid staff and volunteers. We have 262 paid guardians ad litem staff. That includes guardians ad litem, supervisors, managers, and administrative staff. The program has 226 employed guardian ad litems. Some of those are part-time, and we have 43. At the time of this report, January 15th, we had 43 volunteers. We've since recruited an additional 9, and now we have 52. Last year, over the course of the year, 9,973 children were assigned a guardian ad litem in a juvenile court matter. 105 of those assignments were to guardian ad litem volunteers. 9,868 were to employees. Another metric that the statute's been amended to require is that we report on our court reports. Last year, guardians ad litem filed 17,683 court reports for court hearings. The distinction I just like to make there is that sometimes in a single court report will serve for more than one hearing. So for example, if two child protection cases are heard together, or a child protection case and a permanency case are heard together, those are the number of reports that were filed for hearings. 257 of those reports were filed by guardian ad litem volunteers. 5,327 new juvenile cases were assigned to guardian ad litem in 2025. 61 of those were assigned to guardian ad litem volunteers, and 5,266 to employees. Hours worked. That's another section of the amendment that requires us to report on the number of hours worked disaggregated by employee and volunteer. The number of hours worked that's represented in this report is taken from our case management system so that it represents case-related activity. It may not be the total amount, for example, for employees reporting to payroll, which would include leave time and other time that might be not be case-related. And I know for all the lawyers on the committee, the idea that you may be in the chair for 10 hours but only have 6 hours of billable time, I think everyone understands that, and that represents the difference here as well. So guardian ad litem employees logged 324,785 hours in the case management system, and volunteers logged 1,610 hours in the case management system. One of the aspects that I spoke about earlier, technology support and training for volunteers, I think we'll see over time an increase in the volunteer hours logged as a percentage of their time. Complaints filed, there were 19 complaints filed against employees last year, none against volunteers. 16 of the complaints against employees were investigated, and none of the complaints against the employees resulted in discipline last year.
Thank you for your presentation, Mr. Miller. Are there any member questions? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Miller. Lots of focus on the expansion in the volunteers, which is appropriate and certainly of interest to the committee. I'm curious if there's any, if you're looking for paid staff at this time as well, is there room in the budget for that, or are you capped out?
Mr. Miller.
We need support for paid staff, and we submitted a change item to that effect, and the change item that we submitted is essentially identical to what we submitted in the last funding year. And it's absolutely essential when you look at the numbers here and see that, you know, with 52 volunteer guardians ad litem, but we get about 2% of our caseload covered statewide. So if we get even to 200 volunteer guardians ad litem, you know, that's 8% maybe. The guardian ad litem paid staff is essential, and to get them to the median range. So for example, the CAB forensic volunteers who were here, the median of their salary range is about $33 of their starting salary. Our starting salary is $23. Dispositional advisors, $33. Public defender dispositional advisors, $33, maybe a little bit north of $33. And again, guardian ad litem staff, $23. Cases increase in their complexity. We see fewer cases, but cases increase in their complexity, which then increases the demand upon the guardians ad litem. They're appearing in court. They're testifying. They're making recommendations. They're having to synthesize an incredible amount of information, and oftentimes these cases are coming in after extensive involvement outside of the courtroom, which the guardian ad litem is then responsible for understanding and trying to ferret out and make recommendations. So we absolutely need help in that regard, pay for our paid staff.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That raises, you citing the disparity in salary there raises a secondary question, which would be, in those comparisons with those different positions, is there a difference in qualification required for guardian ad litem as opposed to the competition?
For the public, excuse me, thank you for the question. For the public defender disposition advisor, there is. That's a strict bachelor's requirement, as I understand it. For the competency attainment board, it's bachelor's or equivalent, and for us, it's bachelor's or equivalent experience.
Thank you.
Any other member questions? Seeing none. With that, members, we are adjourned. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.